Good afternoon. It is 1:15, and I'm happy to call the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. A quorum is established. And Vice Chair Anderson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair. I move approval.
So Vice Chair Anderson has moved the approval of the minutes of April 21st. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor of the minutes of April 21st, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Minutes of April 21st are adopted. So before we get in, I want to note for the record that Representative Elkins is excused, and we look forward to the discussion today. So members, today we are going to discuss the child care assistance programs. This is a follow-up to a hearing we did in February of 2025 when we looked at these programs and knew that at that point there were 65 child care CCAP programs under investigation according to DHS, which had jurisdiction at the program over the program at the time. So we invited the commissioner of DHS and others who had been involved in the program to attend today. They declined. And their reason for that is that now this program is under the jurisdiction of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, who are here, and we're grateful that you are attending today. I would just like to note for the record that some of the people who used to work in this program did migrate over to DCYF, and we are grateful for them joining us. But there are people who are still at DHS who had direct responsibility for the child care program who are still at DHS. And they should have been here to answer questions, and they are not. And that is very disappointing to the committee. Secondly, I'd like to note for the record that we invited Governor Walz to attend. We first issued an invitation to him on March 9th, and he got his pick of dates. And we never had any response. And then late last night, he declined our invitation. And I have to say, this is incredibly frustrating because the governor's decision-making over the last 9 years, since the first OLA reports on CCAP fraud came out in March and April of 2019, early in his administration, should be addressed by the governor before our committee. And I know he's available today. He's probably in the basement or somewhere in this building because tonight is the State of the State address. So he's not at Jimmy Kimmel. He's not in Spain at a global mobilization conference. He is somewhere here in the building declining to join us. And that is incredibly frustrating. So we will proceed without him, but we will, I'm sure, have follow-up questions both for DHS and for the governor's office, and I'm sure for our friends at DCYF, and we look forward to getting as much on the record as possible. So with that, first we will have a presentation from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Please join us at the testifier table and state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Brown. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much. I'm Tiki Brown, the commissioner for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Pleased to be with you here today. Also pleased to be here with you today on this important topic while we have such important news happening in our state today. I'll address that first. Today is an excellent example of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, local law enforcement, federal partners, each playing its part to end fraud in Minnesota. Each entity, as you know, plays a distinct role in protecting taxpayer dollars, and we are seeing the strength of that collaborative working relationship in action. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families works every day to protect program integrity, and we're pleased to see the state's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and our federal partners taking strong action based on the information that we have shared with them. We will continue to share information with law enforcement to ensure that they are able to conduct thorough criminal investigations. Today's actions put fraudsters on notice that Minnesota does not tolerate fraud in our public programs. Our focus is on program integrity, and it also allows us to highlight the great work and the hard work and care for thousands of child care providers across the state. The vibrant and diverse child care community works every day to ensure that, children are thriving. So I'll now move into the presentation. Minnesota is a state that is committed to helping people, and we've committed to providing services that improve the lives of Minnesotans. Fraud against public programs is unacceptable. It is not a victimless crime, and it harms the same people that we are trying to help with these services. At DCYF, my leadership team and I strive to create a culture of prevention and compliance across the agency. We take a comprehensive approach, ranging from prevention and oversight to investigation and referral for prosecution. This work is imperative to earn and maintain public trust and ensure that funding is used as it is intended for the people who need it. We collaborate with counties, tribes, other state and federal partners to promote effective and accountable program outcomes. This work is influenced by a variety of factors, including creating an agency culture that fosters ethical behavior and accountability across all divisions, training to equip staff, providers, recipients with the knowledge to maintain compliance, adhering to state and federal regulations governing programs and funding, staying responsive to public awareness and scrutiny that may come from the media or other sources, implementing policies that provide clear guidance and procedures for program operations, working with our partners, counties, tribes, and other agencies to strengthen oversight, and being responsive to feedback for process improvement, which includes the most recent report from Tim O'Malley. On our next slide, DCYF was created with a vision of improving the lives of children and families. From the beginning, our structure has held program integrity at the forefront. I informed DCYF leadership and staff that strengthening a culture of compliance was a top goal of the agency. Starting immediately, we began establishing training, new training requirements for staff regarding program integrity and the importance of reporting suspected program violations. Another top priority was ensuring that agency employees knew that they are protected from retaliation for reporting suspected fraud and that they can report anonymously if desired. 10 months ago, the transition to DCYF was completed when we officially welcomed the Office of Inspector General, or the OIG. Prior to that time, DCYF received program integrity support from DHS through an interagency agreement. With this transition, DCYF assumed responsibility for preventing misuse of public funds across certain programs like CCAP. And by centralizing these functions, we strengthen our commitment to accountability, ethical conduct, and the responsible stewardship of public resources. Before we move into program integrity at CCAP, I thought it would be also helpful to ground us in what the Child Care Assistance Program is. The purpose of CCAP is to help families who otherwise would not be able to afford child care, work, or go to school, to be able to afford child care. Annually, the program supports 23,000 children from 12,000 families. In order for the state to make a CCAP payment, a Child Care Assistance Program payment, the family needs to be determined to be eligible, and the provider must register. There are approximately 3,500 child care providers who accept CCAP. The events over the past several months have caused anxiety and fear for many providers, and I appreciate the committee's interest in CCAP, and we share your zero tolerance for fraud. While we have this important conversation, I don't want the critical work that the child care educators do every single day to be overshadowed. The vast number of providers do their very best. They're following the rules, and to suggest otherwise is harmful to providers and thus our families and our communities. We need to continue to support those that care for our children and support families that need help affording child care. So when it comes to administration and oversight, every level of government is involved in supporting the administration and responsible from components of oversight. I recognize there are a lot of words on this slide, but we wanted to highlight many of the rules related to CCAP stem from federal requirements. CCAP is funded by both federal and state dollars, the federal coming through the Child Care Development Fund. Every 3 years, the Administration for Children and Families at the Department of Health and Human Services reviews and approves state plans for spending our child care development funds, for monitoring and oversight, and for general compliance with federal requirements. In Minnesota, counties and tribes are responsible for determining the eligibility of families and the processes associated with doing so. Counties and tribes also conduct investigations and pursue fraud disqualifications at the family level. They may also work on investigations in collaboration with the state. The state's role is to support local agencies through technical assistance, training, and more recently through registering providers. The state is also responsible for provider investigations and audits and has the authority to impose administrative sanctions under certain conditions. On our next slide, at the state level, there have been many budget and policy proposals from the Walz administration that were passed into law with bipartisan support from the legislature since 2019, many of these addressing recommendations from the 2019 Office of Legislative Auditor reports. In addition to this slide, there are four additional slides that are listing legislative changes per year. I won't go through each of those changes, but I'll just highlight a few key bits of information. In 2019, after concerns were raised about CCAP program integrity, Governor Walz brought forward a major program integrity overhaul. As part of that overhaul, he sought and received expanded sanctions, clearer standards, increased transparency, and investments to program integrity infrastructure for the child care assistance program. And since 2019, we have returned frequently with updates to program integrity statutes. In 2021, the governor's budget package includes changes to CCAP and program integrity statutes to strengthen payment control and recover overpayments. All of the changes on this slide were established to limit funds that might be paid to fraudsters and support recovery of any that are, including clarifying for providers and local agencies the statutes governing overpayments, which may be inadvertent errors. In 2023, the governor's budget includes centralization of CCAP provider registration. That's a way to provide integrity and move Minnesota's forward to a statewide electronic attendance record-keeping system. These changes were also made to provide stronger agency authority for the limits on receiving public funds statute and expanding corrective action statutes. In 2024, conditional certification was also added to ensure that the agency can more closely monitor license-exempt centers when needed, and state statute was updated to reflect establishment of DCYF to ensure a seamless transition. And then finally, in 2025, the electronic attendance records keeping requirement was established, kickbacks were banned in state law, and to improve transparency, DCYF was given authority to provide limited disclosure of payment stops so as long as that disclosure did not impede ongoing investigations. We also sought and received two positions in the last budget that were dedicated to implementing the limit on public funds statute and increase our compliance statutes. So again, I won't go through slides 7, 8, and 9. They're just there for your reference. But as you can see, there have been numerous changes to continuously improve program integrity in the child care assistance program. This work has been done on a bipartisan basis to enact them, and we hope to continue to do this work with the legislature. I'll now pass the presentation to Randy Keyes, who is our Office of Inspector General for DCYF.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Keyes. Please state your name again.
Thank you. My name is Randy Keyes. I'm the Inspector General at DCYF. I've been in this role for about 10 months, so I'm new to many of you. So I just want to take a moment to tell you a little bit about how I came into this job. After graduating from law school at the University of Minnesota, I went on active duty as an Army Judge Advocate. I served as a prosecutor in my first role. Later on in my career, I supervised legal offices that included prosecutorial teams. I have extensive experience working with law enforcement in that capacity. When I left the Army, I went to Wisconsin's Department of Children and Family as the senior sort of permanent position in their early childhood division. And there we oversaw the CCAP program, oversaw licensing for the state, established a program integrity unit for the state because in 2010, Wisconsin was dealing with its own CCAP fraud issues. We also took over administration of the CCAP program in Milwaukee County, the most populous county of the state, and we stood up the quality rating and improvement system. So we did a lot of things in a short period of time. After working in that role for a while, I became the chief counsel for the agency, and so very familiar with the federal rules, procedures, and policies that we have to deal with every day. When this job came open, I looked at it as an opportunity to bring that experience here and help the new agency get off to a good start. And so I just want to talk for a couple minutes about how we organize our work around program integrity, and then we'll be able to take questions. The four big boxes here are my team. The early and often team goes out and visits programs, child care programs, in their first year of operation to ensure that they understand the rules and they're following them and providing technical assistance where needed. That's one of the changes that was developed as a result of some of the concerns that arose in 2019. I have a data analytics team that helps us look for red flags and anomalous data so that we can target our investigations where we think we're going to get the most payback. Our licensing team goes out and visits every child care provider in the state every year, and more often if there are complaints or other reasons to go out. And where the counties do that work in the county delegated system, they also go out every year and visit providers. And then I have a team that's focused just on CCAP provider investigations, and they do just that, whether it's compliance visits or more detailed investigations. They're focused on administrative investigations where we can stop payments, recover funds, and disqualify providers from participating in the program in the future. We're good. Let's see if I can go back. Oh, here we go. And I just want to call out our partners here because we don't do this alone. We work closely with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, refer cases of suspected fraud to them so they can do criminal investigations. The CCAP program staff and the compliance staff in the agency are also monitoring the work by the counties, and they can identify concerns and bring them to us. And then the local agencies have a role in determining whether appropriate decisions are made around eligibility, and so they can investigate eligibility determinations, and they can also investigate providers, and they coordinate with us when they do that. Just the steps for CCAP fraud investigation, it's pretty straightforward. We get information, whether it's we develop it ourselves based on data analysis, tips from other people, licensing tips. We look at that information, determine whether or not we already have an investigation open, if there's enough information to support an investigation or justify an investigation. We go out and do investigations. The assessment process is where we take that information and make decisions about what the appropriate sanctions are, whether we're going to disqualify someone, recover funds, or take other administrative actions. And then we notify the parties that are involved, because all of our actions are subject to some kind of appeal action. A couple things that we can do in here that aren't obvious from this: we have the ability to stop payments based on a credible allegation of fraud. That's authority that was, again, added to the statute after 2019, and we use that when we have information that warrants that action, before the investigation is completed, right? So that's a step where we can stop payment while the investigation is going on. And then on here, we do administrative investigations. So if there are allegations that warrant criminal investigation, then we're going to refer that information to BCA or other law enforcement agencies for them to take action. And ultimately, decisions about whether or not someone is criminally prosecuted is made by the prosecutors, not by us. This just highlights some of the actions we can take, and they're spelled out in statute. Discontinue payments, whether it's a stop payment at the beginning of the investigative process or based on a preponderance of the evidence after we've completed our investigation. An order of corrective action, you'll see that. We put some numbers up. You'll see corrective action. That's generally where providers made some minor mistakes, and we're just telling them, hey, this is how you fix this problem, but we're not taking an action that stops payment or stops them from participating in the program. Overpayment is just what it says. You've received more funds than you should have. We want you to pay it back. An administrative disqualification actually stops people from being able to participate in the program. Just some numbers. It's I think you all have the chart. You can see it probably easier there. It's been a pretty active year. This shows 189 open cases. At the time this chart was done, the number's probably higher because every time we go out and do a compliance visit, we are opening an investigation on the provider because we're collecting attendance records and we're doing reviews of that data. After some of the information came to light in December, we increased our rate of compliance checks across child care programs. In January, we went to the top 100 recipients of CCAP across the provider communities. In February and March, we continued to do visits to, and April, we continued to do visits to CCAP providers, and we also looked at other programs based on red flag reports from the data we had. We did some additional work to make our data more usable for our data team to do analysis. Before the beginning of this year, our data resided in several different data systems, so we'd have to go to different data systems to pull a report, and so each report required them to go to four or five different data systems. We've put all that data together in a data lake where it's all accessible at one time. We can go in and do real-time searches, change the search parameters as we're doing it, and develop better and faster reports. We are using all of the tools that we have available to us. We've used stop payments when we had a credible allegation of fraud, and we've used it, I think, probably over 20 times already this year. We are also working with the Attorney General's Office to take advantage of some authority in the statute to do Civil False Claims Act cases, and the Attorney General's Office is looking at some referrals we've made to them. We've looked at gaps in payment withholding and other administrative actions, and we think we have pretty good authority, but we always are looking at is there more that we can do, and we work closely with Assistant Commissioner Barty Wahi's team on all of the different ways that the policy and program integrity tools align. And then, of course, we continue to work closely with BCA and other federal law enforcement agencies to support their investigative work where appropriate. And I think just a reminder, we were here before to talk about there are some additional resources that would help us do our job better, primarily around people and increased data capabilities, and that information you've seen previously, but we reiterate this is where we could really use the help.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, I think we'll go to the next testifier and then we'll bring you back for questions if that's all right. Thank you. Next, we would like to call up Jay Swanson, former manager of the DHS Child Care Provider Investigation Unit. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Swanson. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jay Swanson. Chair Robbins and committee members, as I said, my name is Jay Swanson. I'm a retired state employee and have been for almost 7 years. While I didn't volunteer to be here today, when I was asked to testify, I realized that I had a moral obligation to the honest people of Minnesota to tell you what I experienced. As a bit of background, I was a Minnesota State Trooper for over 34 years, serving in many different assignments over that time, including conducting and supervising criminal investigations. In mid-2014, I retired with the rank of captain. In August of 2014, I was hired by the Department of Human Services as the manager of recipient and child care provider investigations, where I worked until mid-2019. My job at DHS was to oversee three groups of employees, one being the CCAP Fraud Investigation Unit. During my time at DHS, our team of CCAP fraud investigators and I, along with the BCA agents assigned to our group, had a front row seat to watch the fraud happening, and we had regular contact with those committing the fraud. Beginning in 2017, we became dismayed and shocked by the response of some senior DHS officials to whom we reported the fraud to. As I look back with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, I realized that what our team saw was the early stages of a somewhat loosely organized criminal enterprise beginning to pillage Minnesota's public benefit system. In my opening remarks, I'm not going to use the names of individuals involved in the events I will describe. I'm not here in a vendetta. My goal is to help you understand how this happened. I did provide the names to the legislative auditor when I was interviewed in the 2018-2019 timeframe. You should also know that a few of the senior level DHS officials who harassed and abused our unit for committing the sin of trying to expose a huge amount of fraud in the CCAP program are still working at DHS today. From 2014 to early 2017, our unit received tremendous support from the original Inspector General and Deputy Inspector General. These folks, along with the great staff at the DHS Child Care Licensing Unit, were the first ones to discover very strange and unusual activity at certain Minnesota child care centers, as well as suspicious behavior by their owners. This led them to believe that significant CCAP fraud may be taking place. The DHS Child Care Licensing staff spent a great deal of time after we were hired teaching us what would be normal activity at a child care center and what would be abnormal or suspicious. Just so you're aware, our investigators were all retired police officers. They averaged 20 years of experience with extensive experience investigating everything from fraud to narcotics trafficking to homicide. These were veteran cops, but they knew nothing about child care centers. But the DHS licensing folks took care of us. From the beginning, our unit began receiving information, tips, or complaints from a wide variety of sources that we believed were likely indicators of fraud. As an example, one day we received a call from a CCAP mother who called to complain that her child care center owner had stopped paying her the monthly cash kickback they had agreed upon. Another day, a former co-owner of a center called to say that he had been cheated out of his share of the fraud proceeds. Yet another day, a fire department called asking if a child care center was still operating, because they had been trying to conduct a fire safety inspection and had made multiple trips there on different days at different times, but there were never any children or staff at the center. I checked and found that in the last 12 months we had paid the center approximately $1 million and that they were billing for the care of approximately 90 children at a time during two shifts from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., 7 days a week. I wish I could tell you that these types of incidents were rare, but they weren't. This is what our team dealt with on a weekly basis. Once our unit received information we believed was an indicator of CCAP fraud, we would prioritize these tips primarily based on the amount of CCAP funding the center received. Frankly, we were so inundated with tips on centers receiving $700,000 to over $1 million that we didn't have time to focus on centers receiving less funding. Cases were assigned to investigators who would then conduct research on the center and owner and would then initiate physical and electronic surveillance of the center. The surveillance would determine how many adults and children entered the center and the times that they did so. This would later be compared with billing records the center submitted for CCAP payment. If the investigation to this point indicated significant fraud, the information was shared with the BCA agent, who then continued the investigation. If warranted, the agent would eventually obtain a search warrant for the center, at which time computers and phones belonging to the owner and business were seized. At the time of the search warrant, we ordered all payments to the center to be stopped. The DHS forensics lab would then perform forensic examinations on the electronic devices. These exams often resulted in us obtaining our most powerful evidence against those committing fraud. Here are a few of the examples of the evidence I was shown over the years by lab supervisor and staff. From an owner's cell phone, I was shown a text conversation between the owner of the center and a friend. The friend had asked the owner, "How much longer are you going to do the daycare scam?" The owner replied, "Another year or two. I'm going to buy some nice homes in Nairobi. The owner was on public assistance at this time. They happened to be on vacation in Dubai when this text conversation took place. Up to this point, which was early 2017, in the roughly 2.5 years of our existence, our unit had directed CCAP payments to be stopped to 11 child care centers that we could prove had fraudulently billed DHS. These stop payment orders always resulted in the immediate closure of the center because the centers we investigated never had any private paying clients, only publicly funded CCAP clients. Additionally, 5 cases had resulted in felony convictions for fraud-related crimes. I regularly joined with various investigators and agents as we interviewed the owners and employees of the child care centers being investigated. More than once, I heard an owner or employee respond when we asked where they first learned about the daycare scam. They would say they had first heard about it while in the refugee camp in Kenya. These individuals told us that they had heard you could run the scam in a number of different states, but it was easiest and you could make the most money doing it in Minnesota. Additionally, at about this same time, the DHS investigators and BCA agents initiated an investigation of another child care center and found a high amount of billing fraud. Federal agents from the FBI, the IRS Criminal Investigation Unit, and agents from the U.S. Health and Human Services Office Inspector General were invited to join in the investigation due to some of the unusual activity and suspected crimes that we believe we saw. This investigation resulted in the federal indictment in 2017 of the owner of Salama Child Care Center. That owner eventually pled guilty and was sentenced in 2018 to 2 years in prison and was ordered to pay restitution of over $1.4 million. The Salama Child Care Center was located at 1411 Nicollet Avenue in Minneapolis. That address might ring a bell for some of you because of a YouTube video taken last December at the Quality Learning Center, which was being operated at the same address. By mid-2018, our cases had generated some publicity, and the legislature then directed the Office of Legislative Auditor to conduct a special review of the CCAP program. In August of 2018, as I was preparing answers to questions posed to me by the OLA in an email, I was told by a DHS official to submit my answers to them instead of sending them directly to the OLA. When I forwarded my answer regarding what fraud trends we were seeing in CCAP, as I had been directed, I soon had a senior DHS official in my office, angry, red-faced, and almost yelling. The senior DHS official told me to delete a number of paragraphs of the document that I had sent. I then advised this official that I believed what they were telling me to do was illegal. I advised them that Minnesota law requires state employees to cooperate with the OLA and to turn over information as requested. A few days later, the same official told me, "I just came from the commissioner's office and they're sending your document to the OLA. You better be ready for the blank storm that's coming your way." In the following months, members of our unit were harassed and bullied by DHS officials in the following manner. First, DHS paid $90,000 to a consultant with no experience in public benefit program integrity or financial fraud investigations to label the CCAP fraud allegations in my email as unreliable and unable to be proven. During an interview with the consultants, which became heated, I told them that I really didn't care what they put in their report, but if they said there was no fraud or that our investigators were making this up, that when this became public, their company would lose all credibility. I told them that the fraud was so huge that sooner or later it would come to light. Secondly, false derogatory information was placed on a supervisor's performance review by DHS officials. Third, DHS implemented a continuous improvement program with the Fraud Investigation Unit. This process started with the senior continuous improvement official berating our group for approximately 30 minutes, telling us, in essence, we were incompetent and terrible employees. I had never heard of something like this happening to any group of state employees in my 40 years in state government. A DHS assistant commissioner was in the room watching this. Over the next approximately 6 months, we were directed to attend many group meetings to discuss the investigative process at length, and we were given homework assignments to work on between the meetings. These meetings were led by the same DHS official who had berated us so badly in that first meeting. The huge amount of time our team spent in those meetings and on our assignments resulted in investigators and supervisors being unable to conduct hardly any investigative activity over the roughly 6 months of this program. As a result of this program, significant changes were dictated to our unit by the lead official, and this process, the changes to the process included, A, myself and the unit supervisor. Keep in mind, together between the two of us, we had 70 years of criminal investigative experience. We would no longer have the authority to decide which cases would be investigated. That would be done by a committee of three. Two members of the committee were DHS officials with no experience conducting public benefit or financial fraud investigations. I would be the third committee member, although clearly outvoted. Next, the amount of CCAT funding would not play a role in prioritizing cases. We would spend as much time investigating centers receiving a relatively small amount of CCAT money as those receiving much larger amounts. The result of this meant that roughly 50% of our limited investigative capacity would be spent on centers likely billing CCAT for less than $100,000 a year. It would also result in our team spending 50% less investigative hours on cases involving centers billing CCAT over $1 million a year. Next, investigators could only contact BCA agents after receiving permission from a DHS official. Lastly, DHS officials advised the BCA agents to vacate our building. They would no longer have an office at DHS. At this point, in June of 2019, I submitted my resignation / retirement notice effective July of 2019. I advised the members of the Fraud Investigation Unit that I was not going to be a party to this. In closing, I would like to make the committee aware that the CCAP fraud supervisor and I had each worked for the state for 25 and 34 years, respectively, each of us in the Department of Public Safety at the BCA and the State Patrol, where the theft or loss of even $50 would not have been tolerated. I can't tell you how shocked we were to come to the Department of Human Services and learn after a few years that not only was the theft of untold millions of dollars tolerated, but those who tried to stop it would be subjected to the wrath of high-ranking department officials. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson, for your testimony. So I have a number of questions. I'm sure my colleagues have a number of questions. And I think I'd like to, just for clarity, maybe think about the hearing in two sections as we ask our questions, sort of looking back at the material that Mr. Swanson presented, and then also talking with the Commissioner Brown and her team about current things. So, and there may be some overlap in there, but just so we're not running around back and forth a lot, I think understanding how this happened is critical. So we get a handle on it, because as we see in the news today, this is not over. 22 raids are going on or have been going on today, and my understanding is 5 were autism centers, 9 are childcare centers, and the others are a mix of maybe childcare and Feeding Our Future. So this has not been stopped, and I appreciate the work that you're working on, but this has been going on for years, and we still have not finished the job. So with that, I think we have a list already. I'll turn to Vice Chair Anderson, then I'll come back to some of my questions. Okay, Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and sir, God bless you. I mean, you said you did not want to be here, nor do any of us. We truly do not want to be here, and it is a lack of the rules and the regulations that we have neglected here in the state legislature that has gotten this bad. And quite frankly, everyone in Minnesota is appalled. But thank you for sharing your story, and please continue so we can shine a light on this, because the only way we're going to be able to fix this is when brave people like you continue to move forward. My question to you, and you were very thorough in your description, but as you're talking about, you know, when you were reporting to DHS what you were finding, do you think they did not have the tools to prosecute or to stop it? Was there something missing, or why did it continue specifically?
Mr. Swanson.
When our unit began its work in 2014, again, we had some very experienced investigators and experienced BC agents, and we were finding significant amounts of fraud early on, and we felt we had all the support we needed from the DHS Inspector General and Deputy Inspector General. And the first few years, I think we went along and we tried to, deal with the biggest cases that we could. There was a lot of cases we didn't have time to investigate, but we went after those that were stealing the most government money. What we noticed starting in early to mid 2017, we had initially, early on, made some suggestions for policy and legislative changes, and some of those were adopted by DHS as part of their legislative initiatives, and a few became law. We had some success changing CCAP policy. Others, there were disagreements between what we felt would be necessary for program integrity, and others at DHS didn't care for those ideas. But we noticed a change in mid to late 2017, when we would make suggestions about particularly legislative changes, because as we gained more experience and we saw, how these criminals did what they did, and frankly, they were adapting to some of the work we were doing. We had to give a great deal of consideration to what legislative changes could be enacted to stop this, or at least make it a lot more difficult. And what we found was we were getting no support from those people above us. Our legislative initiatives were not being taken seriously by DHS upper management. And in fact, several times in my last couple of years, I was shown early versions of proposed legislation that DHS was going to put forward, theoretically with the idea of improving program integrity and CCAP. And my response was, these aren't going to have much of an impact. But those initiatives were the ones that were adopted and went forward. And then after the OLA incident, or the incident where I was told not to send information to the OLA, support from upper management dropped off a cliff, and it seemed at that point their only goal was to destroy our unit and drive the people out of there.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf.
It's a quick follow-up. So thank you. So basically what you're saying, I mean, if some of your recommendations were taken into account, if you were taken, if you feel more seriously, the things that you reported back during your tenure, what we're seeing right now in the reports of 2025, the FBI raid that's happening today in Minnesota right now in 2026, do you believe that some of these things would have been prevented if they took you seriously?
There's no doubt. It was a serious problem when we started in 2014. Frankly, we were shocked at, the problem we saw when we walked in the door. And we worked very hard to try to go after the people stealing the most amount of state money. But it got even worse while we were doing our work. The number of centers, grew exponentially. At some point towards the end of, my career in 2018 or somewhere around there, we looked and there were 320 child care centers in Hennepin County alone receiving CCAP. Now, some of those are fine centers doing a great job taking care of kids. A significant number of them, we believe, were defrauding CCAP because, frankly, they exhibit the same symptoms as all the other centers that we'd already investigated. So the number of fraudulent centers opening was just growing dramatically. And then...
And Mr. Swanson, if I could interrupt, what are the hallmarks of the fraud you were seeing? So like, what would be the red flags that tipped you off?
Frankly, I think the single biggest one was a child care center would open, and they would often claim to, or they would request a license that would allow them to care for children 7 days a week, up to 16 or 18 hours a day. That's fairly unusual for child care centers in Minnesota. And what happens then is once they would go out and they would recruit mothers with a significant number of children, agree to pay them kickbacks. And what we would notice from these centers, obviously before we even could investigate and determine kickbacks were being paid or that they were fraudulently billing, but we would notice in the first year of operation, they would be billing DHS maybe $800,000 a year for a partial year. And the next year they're billing for over $1 million and it just went up from there. I'm just not aware of too many businesses in Minnesota where you can, open your doors. And frankly, the owners of these child care centers had no experience in child care. So, what other business can you walk into with no experience, open your door, and in a little over a year, you're grossing over $1 million. That's, defies logic.
Thank you. Any follow-up for Representative Altendorf? Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Mr. Swanson, thank you for being here today, and thank you for your continued exposure of this. It struck me there's a biblical proverb that says, a prophet is not welcome in his own hometown. I just appreciate you having talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. One of the questions that I had for you, sir, was the senior official that told you to delete certain comments from your report. And I find that very shocking. But to the best of your knowledge, is that person still in the employ of the state of Minnesota?
I don't believe so.
And do you remember that person's name?
Mr. Swanson.
I do.
I have a feeling that we're going to be talking about this offline, so I'll move on to the next question. I don't want to make you uncomfortable. So early on, as you were looking at some of these, Madam Chair, thank you, as you were looking at some of these initial dollar amount findings, what were some of those initial dollar amounts that you began noticing from a trend line perspective as you began looking into this? And keep in mind, I respect your law enforcement background. You were trained for years, I'm sure, to look for things like this. Could you tell us what some of those were?
So, I'm sorry, some of the dollar amounts?
Some of the early dollar amounts that you brought
Representative
to the attention.
Nash.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So some of the early dollar amounts that you brought to the attention of your superiors, what were those amounts?
As I recall, our initial cases were smaller amounts. We were looking at fraud cases or fraud investigations involving centers billing you know, maybe $500,000 a year or something like that. As time went on, you know, the centers we looked at were billing far more than that.
Thank you, Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't necessarily view $500,000 as a small amount of money. And I don't know that the people of the state of Minnesota view that as a small amount of money. Now, when we deal in budgets up here, our numbers are quite large. The budget of the state of Minnesota is quite large. And $500,000 might be viewed by some as a rounding error. But to a person out in a district like my own or any one of the members on our side or on their side, $500,000 is a lot of money. And when you would bring those to the attention of your superiors and you said, hey, I think we found $500,000 worth of billing discrepancies or irregularities, what were they saying to you about that dollar amount?
Mr. Swanson.
Initially, from 2014 to early 2017, we had tremendous support from it would be the Inspector General and the Deputy Inspector General who oversaw the Office Inspector General that we operated under. We had tremendous support. Their question was, what do you need and what can we do to help you? And I would certainly agree. I'm not saying $500,000 is not a large amount of money. When we started, again, everyone in our unit was shocked and dismayed. It was just, unfortunately, over time, as you see, theft of, you know, several times that amount of money. After several years, we would consider that a smaller amount of money. But I agree with you.
And Madam Chair, just
last
super
one, yes.
So you said you had initial support to pursue those dollar amounts. When did that stop? When did you start getting, please stop bringing us this information?
It stopped in the spring of 2017. I think in the late in 2016, our longtime Inspector General retired, and I think in the first quarter of 2017, our longtime Deputy Inspector General retired, and things changed drastically at that point.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Swanson. So a lot of this is enlightening, especially through the lens of a lot of the instances and this experiences that you have could likely still be playing out today. I guess that would be my first question for you. Whether do you believe that taxpayers are still exposed to the same basic CCAP fraud risks that you warned about during your time?
Mr. Swanson.
Again, I've been gone for almost 7 years. I have absolutely no doubt that large-scale fraud has taken place. On the rare occasions, I might talk with an investigator who's still working on this for the Department of Children, Youth, and Family. My understanding is that some of the insane restrictions that were put on that unit have been lifted. However, I think that what was taking place then is still taking place, and the fact is they're not going to be able to investigate their way out of this. They can't do it fast enough, even if they – at one point before I retired, I told my superiors, if you gave me 100 fraud investigators today, we would do a whole bunch more cases, and the problem would remain the same or maybe get bigger. So it's going to take legislative restrictions on CCAP to stop some of that.
Thank you, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Swanson. And I feared that that was going to be the case. And I think that a lot of recent information, the facts, and specifically the billing that's taken place is a good example of that. And I'm gonna kind of share with the committee one of those. And it's that the top CCAP recipient in the state in 2025 received $4.177 million in reimbursements just last year, and with a licensed capacity of 137 children, which for us, that would mean that if every single child is eligible for CCAP and maximum capacity is maintained through the entire year, the center is receiving nearly $30,500 per child for 2025. And that's pretty tricky because when you look at it, the only way that that seems possible mathematically is for the center to have billed the maximum weekly rate for an infant in Hennepin County with the preferred provider bonus for every child for the entire year. Think about that.
That was the model they were using. Now, the numbers of children, you know, that they're billing for sounds like it's increased some, and the annual CCAP billing is increased dramatically. But that, if you follow the path that they were on when I retired, if that path would have continued, those numbers, I'm sorry to say, don't surprise me.
I mean,
Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, that's wild. This idea, 137 kids, but specifically that they would be infants with preferred provider bonuses. So 137 infants billed at the maximum weekly rate for an entire year. That's one example, the top example. But to your point, it's throughout the system. So let me ask you this, Mr. Swanson. Do you feel as though leadership lacked the legal tools to stop fraud, or did they fail to use the tools it already had?
Mr. Swanson.
Well, I was with the unit. We were still learning, what tools we might need and where our weaknesses were. And, that wasn't a gradual, learning curve there. We continued to learn because, frankly, these providers would change tactics. They would adapt, to what we were doing. It's not that you could come up with one set of statutory changes and that solves the problem, as smart criminals do. They change their ways, as law enforcement catches on to some of their other ways. But I would say by mid-2017, the administration and the leadership at DHS, there was no focus on stopping CCAP fraud. The focus was on stopping the people that are investigating CCAP fraud.
Thank you. And I know there's others on the list, but I'm going to take this opportunity to jump in with one of my questions. So one of the things that came up, so Chair Mary Franzen, back in 2019 when the OLA reports came out, she did a significant data request from DHS. And I have seen some of that, not all of it. And what stands out to me is that there was a group called the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association that came together, and the purpose was to advocate for the child care providers. But my reading of the different documents that I have seen is that they really were trying to limit any changes or oversight. So I'll just give a couple examples. So in one, the lobbyist for the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association objected to limitations on CCAP dollars for dependents of center employees and asked for the governor's help in blocking this legislation. And in a different email, they asked for people limiting that clients, parents could not move among associations, and they wanted to clamp down on that, because they said the biggest problem is the client parent moving around to providers and corrupting the system. And they also wanted DHS to increase absent days, which was a very significant point of fraud. They wanted to increase the allowable absent days from 25 to 100. And in a different place, they asked DHS to lower the burden of, DHS was trying to lower the burden of proof from preponderance of the evidence to clear and convincing, from clear and convincing to preponderance, and they opposed that. And then again, when they were talking about DHS wanted to, the providers, quote, requested that DHS artificially limit the parents' choices in selecting a child care center and prevent parents from moving their children from one center to another. Quote, we are in the business of making money. If we make $50,000 a month but have to pay out $30,000 to mothers in kickbacks, we lose profits. So they were overtly talking to DHS about the kickbacks. in these documents. And they were overtly trying to stop efforts going on at the legislature to put guardrails on these programs. So I would like you to address these allegations, and I would like you to address your experience of working with this group, the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association.
I'm aware of the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association, and I first became made aware of them in late 2016. I reported to the Deputy Inspector General, and she came to me one day and she said, I've been directed to meet, you know, with these people, with the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association. And she said, you know, would you like to attend the meeting? And I said, ma'am, if you need me, I'll be there. But if you can handle the meeting without me, I would prefer to be not within 100 miles of it. And I explained to her that I'd seen who some of the attendees would be at that meeting. And I told the Deputy Inspector General that we already had open fraud investigations on a couple of centers that they operated or were operating. I said, so she said she could handle the meeting without me. And I said, I would appreciate it if you took very close notes on who said what. And immediately after the meeting, she came to my office and sat down, and she told me that they wanted DHS to establish a rule where once parents registered at a child care center, the CCAP parents registered, that they could not move to a different child care center. And she said, I advised them that that wasn't going to happen. We weren't going to create a rule like that. And then she told me about the official saying, if we can basically force these mothers to stay at our child care center where they don't have the option of moving, he said, then we don't have to pay them as many kickbacks or as much of a kickback as we currently have to pay. And that's when I understand this official said, if we make $50,000 a month, but we have to pay $30,000 in kickbacks to the moms, we're losing profit. So that was, I was aware of that meeting in late 2016. So fast forward a few months, it's the spring of 2017. The Deputy Inspector General's retired. And I was notified by the Commissioner's office to attend another meeting with the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association with the same individuals. And I said, well, you know, if there has to be a meeting, I'll attend. My understanding was the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association were trying to meet with DHS officials on weekends at other locations other than DHS offices. And so I said, I'd be willing to attend a meeting if we have to, but it has to be in a DHS building and it has to be during normal work hours. And so I attended a meeting then in April or so of 2017 with another DHS official. And the meeting began. The other DHS official was updating the members of that association on DHS's legislative initiatives that would affect child care centers. And after a period of time, the leader of the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association pointed directly at the other DHS official and said, stop. We don't want to hear any more of that. And then he pointed at me and he said, the person we want to talk to is him, Mr. J, because when his people come to our centers get shut down and the money gets shut off. And I looked at him and I said, yes, that's what we do. And he told me, he goes, I'm going to tell you how you're going to investigate fraud. He said, you're going to give me your cell phone number. He goes, I will tell you which centers are committing fraud. The next day, you and your people will go out and shut them down and shut off their money. And I said, no, that's not going to happen. And he goes, I'm telling you, you're going to give me your cell phone number today, and I will tell you. And I said, sir, I said, people can report fraud to DHS. We have they can report on our website. They can remain anonymous. We have, you know, a phone number they can call. They can remain anonymous. I said, every one of those fraud tips is looked at by me and my team. I said, they were looked at very closely, and, you know, depending on what's contained in them, if we have the ability to investigate them, we will. But I said, we don't take an allegation like that and go out the next day and shut businesses down. That's not how we operate. He said, are you refusing to give me your cell number? I said, that's exactly what's taking place. And he stood up and the group walked out, and that was the end of the meeting.
So for the record, subsequent time has unfolded, and some of the people involved in the Minnesota Minority Child Care Association are now convicted Feeding Our Future fraudsters. Two of them, to be precise, to date. So if this group, which was in front of DHS officials alleging kickbacks, alleging that they were going to determine who was fraudulent, who was not, what should DHS have done differently to deal with this group who was trying to shut down guardrails? And would that have helped so that a stronger stance during the child care fraud years may have prevented some of the Feeding Our Future?
Frankly, Chair, after that first meeting, when they wanted DHS to restrict the child care centers that parents would go to, and for the reasons they gave, if I would have been the commissioner, that would have been the last meeting DHS had with that association, because they exposed who they were. They exposed the fact that they were criminals. Any further contact with that group would serve no useful purpose. The 45 minutes I spent with them served no useful purpose.
But it did continue.
It did continue. Would the chair like me to outline a little bit more about what I learned about that?
No, I don't think we have time. I think we're going to move on, but thank you. Representative Anderson.
So the presentation by the department earlier, it has the investigation summary by calendar year, and I don't know if you have a copy, but I wanted to ask you about this. So like in 2019, and these are years after you were gone, right? You, there were, 95 cases open. Of that, 11 were referred to law enforcement and 21 were administrative sanctions, resulted in two convictions. But every year since then, the administrative sanctions number has gone way up. So, for example, in 25, last year, there were 107 cases of the new cases open, and some were from the previous years. But there were 107 that were administrative sanctions. That's how they were dealt with. And only three were referred to law enforcement. None were there any criminal convictions. And, in fact, since the end of 2019, there's only been two CCAP cases that have resulted in criminal convictions. Only two. Since the end of 2019, there have been, to date, starting in 2020, 28 only that were total since 2020 that have been referred to law enforcement. But there are several hundred, maybe 500, just looking at these numbers quick, that have actually been dealt with administrative sanctions. So are those the kind of numbers that you saw before where almost none were actually referred to law enforcement?
Absolutely not.
Mr. Swanson.
Because, frankly, if one wants to get technical about it, theft of any government money is a felony. And I'm not surprised by those numbers, because the system that they forced upon our unit right before I retired that's the result I would have expected, because they were advocating, the department was advocating cases be looked at, not as in-depth, but decisions would be made, you know, very quickly. No, I'm going to tell you that administrative sanctions, you know, certainly plays a role in public program integrity, but by significantly reducing or eliminating the threat of criminal prosecution, the problem ends up is a child care center opens. You know, there's an owner or two owners or three owners, or whatever the case may be. And, you know, they start billing CCAP fraudulently. And as we see, they can make a lot of money in a fairly short period of time. DHS catches on to them, boom, they stop the payments. They administratively disqualify, you know, the owner or owners. If there's no criminal penalties, what's happened is they just operated a criminal center or a child care center for a year, 2 years, however long it took before they got caught. They made several million dollars, and now they're administratively disqualified. You know, if the owner of the center was a male, his wife, his sister, or his cousin could then open that child care center, boom, start billing CCAP again. They're not administratively disqualified. You wouldn't even have to buy furniture or play equipment or anything like that. You could just leave it in there. They could, someone else could apply for a child care center license and they're back up and running. So there's, if you see, there's just no deterrent and they can make a lot of money.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
No, just thank you. So I just, this is just shocking to me that only like even last year, okay, 107 centers had administrative functions. Only three were referred to law enforcement and zero convictions, and very similar in years before that. So there are no consequences for people.
Right. And so. Thank you, Vice Chair Anderson. And I think that's the point that I hope the public takes from this, that when they shut down the criminal investigative unit in the spring and summer of 2019, early in the Walz administration, it took away the criminal deterrent. And it was very overt. The OLA reports came out in March and April of 2019, which included the memo that Mr. Swanson had submitted to the OLA that DHS had tried to suppress, but eventually it got included as an appendix to the OLA report. Those reports were at the spring of 2019. By June of 2019, that criminal investigation unit had been shut down. They were barred from talking to the BCA. The BCA was forced out of the department, and they were told no more criminal investigations. It's all going to be administrative. So this was a willful decision by DHS to shut down the criminal angle of this, and that is why we are still dealing with CCAP fraud today. And I'm going to excuse you, Mr. Swanson, and invite DCYF to come back. But while I'm doing that, I want to highlight like a real-time example of what you just talked about, how they close one. So members, I did a FOIA request. You can be excused, Mr. Swanson, or you can stay. So the Future Leaders Early Learning Center was the number one recipient of CCAP money, and it was also a Feeding Our Future charge center. And they closed. Sorry, I have to look at my notes. They closed. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong one. Creative Minds Daycare Center. They closed on October 1st of 2025, last fall. And the same day, at the same location, Super Kids Daycare Center opened on October 1st, 2025. So Creative Minds had billed just in 2025, $2.3 million. Thus far, the one that replaced it on the same day has already billed $471,000. So, Commissioner, how can this happen? In your testimony, you said you do site visits. You do licensing. How could one close down and another one open the same day and be billing all this money without any interruption?
Thank you, Chair, and members for the question. I'd actually like to have the Inspector General speak in more detail about the licensing process.
Thank you. Inspector General, please restate your name.
Hi, Randy Keyes, Inspector General, DCYF. So I don't have specific details on the question you're asking. I think changes in ownership can happen in a planned process where we're advised ahead of time that a new owner wants to take over the business. They go through the licensing process, and then we try to facilitate the transfer so that it doesn't disrupt the care of children. So that's an example of how a child care center can close and another one open at the same location on the same day. I don't know if that's specifically what happened in this case, but that's generally one of the things that we try to do if there's a change in ownership of the business is to facilitate the transfer. But it requires a complete application and licensing review. It's not, you don't just hand the keys and start the business. You have to go through the whole new licensing application and all the background studies and all the other requirements that are outlined in statute.
So they would presumably have done that before they change ownership on the door on the same day?
For someone to have a license to operate a business at a new location, they would have had to go on through the licensing process.
Thank you. I look forward to following up on that. The next question I have for you is many of the Feeding Our Future sites were also childcare sites. 58 of the CCAP-funded centers were Feeding Our Future sites. 30 still have active licenses. So please discuss how you've reviewed those sites, what guardrails are on them, and I think most Minnesotans would find that troubling.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we, as we do with all information we receive from other agencies about concerns related to child care centers, we follow up with the information that's available. We go out and do visits if necessary, investigations. If we find sufficient evidence that supports taking action, we would do that. Whether there were problems at the child care center versus the Feeding Our Future, you're asking me to speak generally, and so I'm speaking generally. We would have looked to see if there was sufficient information to take action against the child care center. We continue to receive information as new prosecutions and investigations unfold. Just today, we were reviewing information that was made public about searches and taking action. So it's an ongoing process. And if we didn't take action, it's because we didn't have sufficient information to support that action.
And in the old days, when there was a criminal investigation unit at DHS, and now where it would be under your jurisdiction, they could take action. They could get search warrants. They did surveillance. They seized computers and cell phones. Would you want to reinstate a criminal investigation unit in DCYF for child care?
Madam Chair, no. It's very important in our system to ensure that administrative investigations are kept separate from criminal investigations. I have different authority. My investigators can go into a child care center without a search warrant. We can seize records without a search warrant. If that type of administrative data then is used in the criminal investigation, that may compromise the ability to prosecute someone. So we need to keep the lines between administrative investigations and criminal investigations separate. We have a very good working relationship with the BCA. I meet with the BCA leadership regularly, including Superintendent Evans. My team has meetings as often as weekly with members of the BCA team that support that work. And so we are not losing something by operating in two different locations. What we're doing is protecting the integrity of the investigations and our ability to use that information.
Thank you. I will go to Lee Pinto next, but I would just like to say one of the flags that has been repeatedly cited is that the license capacity is different from the CCAP, individual unique CCAP children served. And I did a FOIA request from you guys, and it's stunning to me, stunning, how there are so many centers where they are serving hundreds more and billing for hundreds more than they're licensed for. So can you explain to me why that is and why they're not, how many of them are under investigation? How many, last year there were 65 active investigations. How many are there currently? And why are you possibly not investigating literally pages where their license capacity is well under what they're serving?
Madam Chair, members. So the simplest explanation is that if you can't assume that the center only operates one shift. So if they operate two shifts of care, then 137, if that's the license capacity, that's how many children can be present at any given time.
Right.
If you go to Dodge Nature Center, for instance, they run multiple part-day programs. And so the number of children coming in and out of that center is not 137 or whatever their license capacity is. It's going to depend on how many different programs they're running. And so you can have more than one child billed on CCAP in a center on a day. And so you can't just take the license capacity and assume that that equals how many children they're limited to in CCAP. I think there was a second question.
Thank you. I assume that was the answer, and I appreciate that. But are you investigating this? Because the numbers are astounding. Sometimes it's 3x the licensing capacity. So that would be more than two shifts. How is that happening?
Yes, Madam Chair. And we saw this in Wisconsin when I was working there. One of the red flags that we look at is the number of children per licensed slot. And so that's information that we look at. You ask about the number of open investigations, it's over 190 right now. And that again is because every compliance visit results in an open investigation. And we are continuing to do an accelerated rate of compliance visits. We haven't done a lot of red flag analysis on the top 100 CCAP providers because we went to every one of them. So we can either do sort of fine-tuning our work and going out based on red flag reports, or we can just go to everybody who's at the top of the list as far as CCAP revenue, and that's the approach that we've taken this year to ensure that every one of them gets visited no matter what their data shows.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just following up on a couple of things. What you were just asking about or saying regarding centers billing more, just if you have any information I'm sure that you do to share regarding that. I know we have a lot of materials online relating to the hearing, but I was sort of looking and I didn't see anything in the materials we have for today containing the information you described about kind of how much is being billed, et cetera. If you could just share that with the committee members, Chair, if you're willing to do that.
Happy to do that.
Thank you so much. And then I was going to ask about, this is a nice transition, about this issue about criminal investigations. I had heard the chair make a comment at one point that there were no more in criminal investigations. I know that criminal investigation unit has moved out of DCYF, and Inspector General, you provided good background as to why. Can you just talk about the relationship with the BCA then? Because in fact, with the referrals to law enforcement, it looks like there's a lot of criminal investigating happening. It's just happening via the BCA. Can you just talk about that relationship?
Yes, Inspector General Keith.
Chair, members, I wanted to mention that, so we have on this document, it says 5 referrals to BCA. That is a sort of formal tracking that we use if we do a formal referral. We meet with BCA regularly and we discuss cases that have come to our attention, and part of that conversation is who's the best to do the investigation. And most of the time we want to do the investigation in the administrative area first, because we have the authority to stop the payments. And the criminal investigation doesn't have that authority, and they can be lengthy, and especially if it gets into prosecution. And so we want to ensure that we do the administrative investigation first, that we take action to stop the payments if appropriate or disqualify people. Most of the criminal investigations involve looking at historical data. There are times when if an agency asks us, we would let them go first with a criminal investigation because it's part of our job to support them. In addition to those five referrals, as I mentioned, my team meets regularly with BCA to talk about cases. We're also required by the governor's executive order to report all allegations of fraud to BCA. And additionally, there's an annual report, and then we also make reports to OLA. So information gets shared fairly broadly with agencies that have investigative authority.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then there was a comment made earlier about the number of referrals to law enforcement, number of convictions, and I guess I note that the number of convictions is quite low compared to the number of referrals. I guess the way that I read that is recognizing how hard it can be to achieve a conviction in general in many of these cases. Can you just talk about, there was a question like, boy, it seemed like these number of referrals to law enforcement is so low. But if the number of convictions is so much lower, that's an indication how challenging it is. I don't know that's necessarily a sign that many more referrals should be made, because in fact, you're already making, there's quite a few cases being referred where in fact, there's unfortunately not enough that the BCA and prosecutors can go after. Can you just talk about kind of the relationship between the referrals and the relatively low number of convictions?
Mr. Keyes.
Madam Chair, members, I try not to talk about other people's work. My work stops at the point we make the referral to BCA, and then we provide information in response to requests from law enforcement agencies. But the decisions about what to investigate, how to investigate, what work to prioritize, or for the prosecutors, whether there's sufficient evidence, whether it fits their workload, all of those things are decisions that are not in my sphere to manage or oversee.
Okay. Real quick question, Madam
Yes.
Chair. These prosecutions are being done by the U.S. attorney, by the county attorney. I would think not the AG, but can you just tell when there are prosecutions in these cases, which office is that?
Mr. Keyes.
Madam Chair, members, criminal prosecutions in this area generally go to the county district attorney.
Okay.
That's where BCA would refer cases. Okay. The attorney general's office, other than the medical care fraud unit, doesn't do prosecutions in this area. And then, of course, I have no control over what federal agencies do and U.S. attorneys. We simply cooperate with their requests.
Okay. I'll have a comment at the end, but I'll leave it that.
Thank you.
Chair, thank you.
And it would be helpful to know the number of cases that are referred to the county attorneys and whether they decline the cases or not. So if you could follow up with me on that, or I'll ask the BCA.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's a BCA question.
Thank you. So next we're going to go to Representative Nash, but while we're doing that, I had a video we were going to show that I'd like Commissioner Brown to respond to. Oh, I guess if it takes time, we'll go to Nash first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question for the Inspector General and one to Commissioner Brown. To the Inspector General. To Mr. Swanson's conversation and your follow-up on the, we'll call it the same-day swap for operations, when you're looking at a license owner or a business that is shutting down and somebody else is going to resume that operation in that same facility, sort of at the flick of a switch like I do on my microphone, what are the indicators that you're looking at to see the interrelatedness between those as one is shutting down and one is being stood back up? Because as we've heard, there's relational owners, there's some things that to me seem pretty shady, but if you could maybe shed some light on that.
Mr. Keyes.
Madam Chair, members, that's something we spent a lot of time looking at over the last several months because we've taken so many actions to shut down providers since we've been in this role at DCYF. We look at who is applying for the license, who the controlling individuals are. We look at whether or not there's any disqualifications that would prevent them from assuming operations for that center. They have to get through the background check process, making sure that they're qualified to run the center, that the equipment and everything is there, the site is prepared. As a state agency, right, we have to make decisions based on evidence and follow the statutes that are that guide our work. And so it's sometimes frustrating for us too, because I can't just say, well, I know this person's going to do something bad. I have to have some authority that justifies stopping them. And so we've also talked a little bit about other things that we can strengthen in that area, and we expect at the next legislative session to come in with some recommendations around that. But we're still working through that process and trying to really dig into what our authorities are and make sure we're using every tool that we have available.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And just very briefly to the Inspector General, are you looking for relational indices of connectedness between somebody who's has lost their ability to operate and that relationship to the person who's going to be standing that new business up the very next day, quite possibly?
Mr. Keyes.
Madam Chair, member, yes. We are looking at the people that are applying for the license, who are applying to be controlling individuals. We can look and see if they're connected. There's some authority in the statute based on associated individuals to take action. And so we're looking at that and trying to identify wherever we have authority. And we're also looking for gaps in that authority so we can strengthen that. Because I think that's an area where there may be some room to improve that.
Okay. And Madam Chair, to the Commissioner.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, since you become the commissioner of the now DCYF, can you tell us of the employees that were present during the time that Mr. Swanson was talking about the suppression of reports and allegations being brought forward? Are any of those still employed by the state?
Commissioner Brown.
Madam Chair and members, I am not certain. This is the first I've heard of Mr. Swanson's testimony, and I would assume if some of the same licensing team was employed with DHS. Some of that team did transfer over. In terms of senior leadership, the senior leadership team was brand new at DCYF, and so that there should be no overlap in terms of the staffing from that level. But not having seen the list of employees that Mr. Swanson worked with at that time, I'd have to look into any overlap.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and then I'll be done. So, Commissioner, is it safe to say that some of the people who might have been trying to suppress investigations are still in the employ of the state of Minnesota in a similar capacity?
Commissioner Brown.
Madam Chair and members, difficult to say. In terms of what I heard today was the team that Mr. Swanson was working with appeared to be working together and working well. Some of those team members may have transferred over to DCYF. From a leadership perspective, not having names or understanding of where those individuals are, I'm not certain.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
Would you be able to get us a list of those that you might go back and provide to the committee after this meeting is over today?
Thank you. Yes, because that was one of the concerns when we asked DHS to come and testify, because we wanted to make sure we had people who were there before you took over in, I believe, April of last year. They told us that all the relevant people had transferred to DCYF, so understanding this personnel issue is important. All right, Representative Altendorf. Oh, are you ready for the clip? All right, we have a clip, Commissioner Brown.
Quality Learning Center closed. One of the centers, Quality Learning Center, closed just over a week ago. I think another one that was mentioned had closed maybe even several years ago. So there have been ongoing investigations with several of those centers. None of those investigations uncovered findings of fraud.
Data Shirley used in this video show those daycares receive millions in taxpayer money.
There have been ongoing investigations with several of those centers. None of those investigations uncovered findings of fraud.
Brown confirmed that the daycares in Shirley's video have active licenses with the state and continue receiving payments. The exception, one that closed years ago, and the misspelled Quality Learning Center, which Brown says permanently closed last week. In a strange contradiction, however, our cameras this afternoon captured dozens of children being dropped off at that daycare, the manager telling us they are legitimate, they are open, and they never have been closed.
Thank you. So, Commissioner, there's a lot of confusion about this, and this was one of the sites rated today by the FBI. So in your statement, you said that they had been closed. In the document I received from your office, it says they didn't close until January 6th of this year. So can you please walk us through this confusion and whether you said there was no fraud found at the Quality Learning Center when indeed it looks like they're being investigated for fraud by the feds right now. So can you please address this?
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the question. When we received information on December 19th that Quality Learning Center intended to close voluntarily, and it was not at the result of any action of the agency. On December 29th, the clip that you showed, I referenced that it intended to close, and that was the information that we had at the time. When the licensing investigators visited that very same day, that's when we were told that the center intended to remain open. However, on January 6th, the center did request to close their license, and it was closed effective January 6th of 2026 and is currently not open.
So they closed voluntarily. They were not shut down by your department.
They were not shut down by our department.
And you had no findings of fraud?
I can have the Inspector General speak to some more information around that. There were several of the centers that were identified in the video that had active investigations ongoing, and the Inspector General can speak more to that.
Thank you, Inspector General.
Madam Chair, members, on December 30th of 2025, we imposed the limits on receiving public funds and stopped payments to Quality Learning Center. They notified us a little while after that they were closing, and they closed on January 6th. So we did not revoke their license or disqualify them, but we did stop CCAP payments to them.
All right. Well, in the video, you had said they had closed. So I just want to point out that discrepancy. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question really relies around, I'm on the Children and Family Committee, and when we were talking about addressing daycare fraud in that committee, there was not acknowledgement of fraud being in the state at all. In fact, when we were talking about fraud, often it was referred to as alleged. Today, with the FBI raid, both Tim Walz and your agency has taken credit and saying that these raids are because of state, county, and federal cooperation. So my question is, when did you start cooperating with the federal government on this? That would be my question.
Commissioner Brown, or Mr. Keyes.
Madam Chair, members, we've had a long working relationship with federal agencies. This is not something that just started in the last couple months. It's something that the CCAP investigators have been doing since before I got here. We did the same thing in Wisconsin in 2010. We worked with the FBI on cases that they investigated. So we are not part of the law enforcement team. We're not working with them day to day, but we do provide information to them when they request it about cases, payments, and similar data. And that's a relationship that's been going on for a while and is ongoing. Same information that we provide to BCA when they request it, or other federal law enforcement agencies, because it's not exclusively the FBI.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we're running out of time, but I just, this is from a constituent of mine. So she lives in my district, but worked for Hennepin County, and it is just unbelievable, case after case after case. She is turning into a whistleblower. And for the agency, there is so many instances where, let me just read one, $239,000 of child care assistance between 3 years for five children. She lists the two daycares, and then she said, it makes me laugh, because those exact same expenditures were also being charged to another daycare. It was literally five children duplicates, two different daycares. What my point is the agency really needs to tighten up. This is happening under your watch. This is a constituent in my district, and I want to say to the people of Minnesota, we are listening to you, we are hearing the whistleblowers, and we need to have more whistleblowers come forward. That is the only way this is going to end, and it is just unbelievable and disappointing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Inspector General and Commissioner, I find your words, your statements, to not be in line with reality or the facts, especially as it relates to the Quality Learning Center. And let's be quite clear here, because the record was just corrected earlier this afternoon as this hearing was kicking off. The FBI director responded to the governor and said explicitly, this FBI and DOJ with our DHS partners at the Department of Homeland Security drafted and executed every search warrant today. But go ahead and take credit for our work while we smoke out the fraud plaguing Minnesota under your governorship. That's what the FBI director said in response to Governor Walz today as this hearing began. And it's pretty consistent here that you are just straight up lying. You are straight up lying to the people. You are not enforcing the law, and that is your job to do. And then you come here in front of this committee and you lie to us. You straight up lie. You lie in front of the cameras in response to the Nick Shirley videos. You tell us that following his visits, that you sent inspectors out to the sites. And your words, Commissioner, were, kids are present at all the sites, except for the site that's not yet open. These are your words. You're lying, and you're allowing taxpayer money to flow through your agency to fraudsters that are connected to a huge industrial-scale fraud ring. I don't know why you haven't resigned already.
Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had one thought, and I just heard Representative Schultz speak. I guess I'll remind all of us that our local media looked at the Nick Shirley video and fully debunked it. That is not to say that there's not significant concerns that we need to be addressing. We absolutely need to. To rely on FBI Director Kash Patel as a source of any truthful information, I think is really concerning when you look at his track record. So I guess I'm pretty bewildered by this approach. Maybe just a question, Commissioner Brown, Inspector General, if you know, did the BCA or state investigators participate in the raids today?
Commissioner Brown or Inspector General Keyes?
If you know.
Madam Chair, members, my information is the same information that the members of the committee have. It's public information. I think BCA released a statement saying that they participated in the raids. And so that's the public information that's available.
Okay.
And I don't want to comment on any other work we may have done separate from that.
Okay.
Thank you, Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then I guess I'll expect Representative Schultz and all of us to find out whether the BCA is lying or whether Kash Patel is lying. I have a sense, and I think it's probably going to be pretty easy to verify. If it turns out Kash Patel is lying about this, let's make sure that we keep it in mind many other times as well. This is, I appreciate the attention to this as we have. I think this is our second to last hearing. Every effort to root out fraud in public programs and anywhere in our society is extremely important, and it's especially important when we're talking about getting kids off to a great start. That's critical. So I appreciate the efforts of everybody working on that, including the two of you. I want to make sure that members of the committee and members of the public are aware we've got a lot of materials about significant changes made since the allegations from 2017, 2018, then the OLA reports in 2019. One of the documents is one that was from the very first hearing of the committee overseeing the CCAP program in February 2020, talking about the changes that were made just in those 2 years, received praise from Republican and DFL members as well. Then the following year, more information about changes. There's a number of summaries and a lot that have gone into this, and it's absolutely critical that we continue to improve integrity in our programs, especially this one. If my colleagues or anybody else have ideas for how to further improve the programs, we certainly need to do that and receive that information and continue to improve. I saw the slide you had, Commissioner, Inspector General, about additional proposals that you have. We want input about how to do that. I am glad that you provided the information that contributed to the to the searches today. I have significant concerns about the partnership with the federal government, given that it was, in fact, the Nick Shirley video that ended up driving. We know the harm that our state experienced in December and January, especially that escalation in January and February. But I'm glad that it appears that there's that partnership happened today. We want to make sure that we root out fraud wherever we can find it. So I appreciate your work and everybody that is going after fraud in all of our programs, certainly including this one, and making sure that kids are getting the support that they need, which is the whole point of this, as we know that parents are experiencing a lot of challenges. So thank you, Chair, for the time for this, and I'll appreciate continuing to be in touch. Thanks.
Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Inspector General. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. We appreciate all of the testifiers. And I just want the public to understand the history of this and that we are still dealing with it. So I appreciate the work that's gone on to tighten controls and the legislative fixes you are still working on. We definitely want to take a look at. But I think it's very important to know, and one of the quick follow-up questions I had is that the two criminal investigations you say, criminal convictions you say have been achieved, when our staff researched this, we didn't find any criminal convictions since 2017. So, 2019 was the last two, and they were U.S. U.S. attorney cases, not county cases. So if you could just give me the names of those cases, I would like to understand that. Because it seems that what was going on in 2017 and up to 2019 was they were, when the criminal investigation unit was embedded in DHS, it was having an effect. That's when we got the first convictions. That's when we were making traction. And when those OLA reports came out, that unit was shut down. Those people in the unit were subject to significant abuse by their superiors. There was an attempt to suppress the information given to the OLA, and we didn't even get into it, but that report that DHS commissioned to oversee this work by a consultant, DHS retained oversight of that report. So they came out with their initial report, DHS looked at it, and they substantially scaled back the fraud in the report based on DHS's review. So another attempt at a cover-up of the scale of this fraud, and to go from doing criminal investigations to saying we're only doing administrative, as Mr. Swanson said very well, that takes away the deterrent. Because people know they can make a lot of money, and if they're only going to get an administrative slap on the hand, then they'll just recycle and send it to their cousin or their friend or their relative and keep the business going. And we've documented in this committee webs of these relationships of fraud, where not only is it within restarting a CCAP business, but it's also then morphing into adult daycare, assisted living, autism centers, and the web grows. And that is what we have failed to address as a legislature and certainly within the Walz administration. We have to stop these webs of fraud that keep growing. And I want to be a partner in that work. I think you want to be a partner in that work. And we must continue to tell the truth about how well this work is getting done and get to the bottom of it, because taxpayers and citizens are depending on us. Thank you. We are adjourned.